that when they hear David and Celeste, they say, ah, I'm home. And I think there are a lot of people who probably agree with her. There's something about finding WILL signal that does make it feel like home. And if you feel the same way, we hope you'll join them in their challenge, because they want to hear from 10 listeners by 1:15 this afternoon. Now, this has been a challenge that's been underway for a few hours, and we're coming down to the last few minutes now, and we still need two more calls to meet this challenge. Now, this is a $200 challenge. That means when we hear from the 10th caller, the Schraders will add an additional $200 to our pledge total. So we have a great opportunity here, but time is running out.
Especially in these final days of the fall pledge drive. We have today, tomorrow, and then half a day Saturday here on AM 580, and that's it. So if you've been waiting till the final moments, I'd like to say right about now, we're getting into those final 48 hours of our fall pledge drive here on AM 580. Let's go into Pledge Central right now. Valerie Gadbury is standing by. And Valerie, again, at last word, we needed two calls.
That's right. We had a volunteer came in to help answer phones, and she filled out a pledge while she was here. So we need to thank Millie Davis very much.
Thank you, Millie.
She did a dual deed for us. And I have a couple of other names. Patrick Bauer from Effingham called. Paul Merrigan Thaler, I hope I said that right, from Champaign called. We had Jeremy Hobson, and his name's been in the news, call from Washington, D.C. So, hey, if he can call us from that far, what about people that are right here? So we're almost home. I have, what, I can't count, but close to 7 minutes left. So
All
we
right.
only need two more, 244-9455.
Thanks, Valerie. 244-WILL. We had a recent email from a gentleman who lives in Springfield, Dan, speaking of traveling around and listening to the radio station, who does some traveling between Springfield and Chicago and apparently Indianapolis. And he listens to the radio station once he gets north of Springfield into our signal area, all the way up to Chicago and over to Indianapolis. And he was expressing how great it would be if he could also hear it in Springfield when he was home, because he does miss it. And he always tunes in when he travels. And I know that a lot of people listen. We've heard from people in Glen Carbon. You have to try real hard to hear us in Glen Carbon. This gentleman in Springfield was asking, and Ed West, our engineer, will consult with him on the best way to try to pull the signal in better in Springfield. We have people in Kankakee. We've heard from people down regularly in Terre Haute, as far south as Mount Vernon, Illinois. If this service is something that you listen to on a daily basis, we need to hear from you right now. Just two calls, and we need to hear by 1:15 from two more at 244-9455. Make a $40 pledge. Become a friend of WILL. But you need to make the call right now. If you've been planning on making the call and you really want to do it when it's going to mean a lot, now is one of those times because of the $200 that we'll have added onto the Schraders pledge.
And I think we're right around $47,000 raised so far, and we're hoping to reach the $55,000 mark by the end of the day today. If we're going to do that, we must get the phones ringing now. So if you can, why not consider maybe a $60 pledge? That's just $5 a month. We'll put it on the installment plan for you. It's very simple, but the phone call comes first, 217-244-9455.
Mm-hmm. And if you've already made a pledge this week, perhaps maybe you can call and add $10 to it. But the important thing is to make the phone ring. We're not going to sit.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Welcome to the once-a-month discussion we call Computers and You. Let's for a moment go back in time. September 11, 1998, about 14 months ago, the release of the Starr Report. Millions of us read the report on the web. That day, America Online recorded over 800,000 downloads of the report. other sources also saw great demand. You could read the report online before you could read it in the newspaper delivered to your front porch. It was a cyber event, and it heralded a change in our relationship to government. In this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, we get the latest scoop on e-politics. Two guests join us. They are pioneers in the field of cyber advocacy. Their names, Pam Fielding and Phil Addy. Phil Addy is the former electronic media manager for the Human Rights Campaign. In that job, he launched one of the Internet's most comprehensive online action centers. Members of the Human Rights Campaign and general users used the center to access news briefings, research voting records, track legislation, and send messages to lawmakers. In 1997, Web Magazine rated it as the net's top political site. Today, Phil Addy is director of the Communications and Policy Technology Network, a national association of public affairs, policy, and political internet strategy and production professionals. Pam Fielding is a policy writer and cyber lobbyist. She designed and launched the National Cyber Advocacy Program for the National Education Association. Her campaigns on the net have been covered by dozens of publications around the country. And Pam Fielding is co-author with Daniel Bennett of the new book, The Net Effect: How Cyber Advocacy is Changing the Political Landscape. If you've got questions, give us a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else in Illinois or Indiana, call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. Pam, Phil, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Celeste.
It's a pleasure to be here, Celeste. Thanks for having us.
Sure. Talk with us, if you would, about the impact the electronic release of the STAR report had on the political landscape a little more than a year ago. Pam, maybe you want to start here, because this is material that you cover in your book, The Net Effect.
Yes. You know, the day the STAR report was released online was a red-letter day for what we now call cyber advocacy. People felt incredibly strongly, whether they were pro-impeachment, against impeachment, people found their way to the Internet. People like my own mother found their way online, who had never been there before, looked at that report, and they started talking. They started talking to each other. We had, you know, mothers emailing daughters, and somewhere along the line, we felt pretty strongly, and we started emailing our members of Congress about how we felt. And what we had was a moment when the Internet had reached that critical mass, and we had a political event bar none. And put that together, and we had the start, the real start of cyber advocacy that we know today.
Hmm. Phil, it sounds like you want to add something.
The STAR report also showed another interesting aspect of the Internet, and that's directly connecting politicians with individuals in the public directly. And the flip side of that is it enables the public and every citizen to engage in the political arena directly. And it was an interesting tactic that the Republicans employed in their effort to impeach the president, to release the report on the Internet and have it accessible instantaneously to every citizen in the United States in order to try and show their claim that the president should be impeached. And what actually I think backfired on them was that the net was used by their opponents on the Democratic side equally as effectively in an effort by some folks in California creating a site called MoveOn.org, where they amassed hundreds of thousands of individuals pledging hundreds of thousands of dollars to an effort to defeat every single Republican candidate who was trying to impeach the president, money that would go into a PAC to try and defeat them in the 2000 election. And it was one of the most impressive fundraising efforts on the Internet we've ever seen.
Yeah. This also shows here how important speed is. At once we have the Republicans releasing this electronically and the Democrats answering with another movement. So speed is at the essence of cyber advocacy.
Absolutely. It is about speed and connecting people instantly to the process. You know, no longer are we talking about finding the stamp, looking for the envelope, trying to remember that address up on Capitol Hill. And we had a process that is not intimidating. You know, today you can go to a website, there's, you know, thousands of them, where technology exists to allow you to type in your zip code, find out who your members of Congress are, and instantly send an email message to the Hill. And those constituent email messages count.
Hmm. Is speed also a weakness, though? Can we get activated before we've thought things through?
Oh, absolutely. One of the key things that I'm focusing on is what I think is the inevitable outcome of this connected new world, where once every individual is connected to the internet, once broadband communication is accessible in every household, which, according to the president's budget in 1997, would be 80% of the American public by the year 2003. I think it's going to be actually more than that in 2003. But once that happens, you're going to have an arena where accumulating 50% plus one of the American public to go on record in favor or against an issue will be possible. And it'll force us to reevaluate our decision-making process. How much do we rely on Congress? What happens when Congress makes a move that is unpopular with the American public? They're going to want the ability to override Congress. And whether that's abolishing Congress altogether, which I don't think is going to happen, or creating maybe a fourth check in the checks and balances system is something that we're going to be looking at in our lifetime. With that, it allows the rise of charismatic individuals to sway the American public in a way that has never been possible before. I mean, any individual will have the power to launch an internet campaign to tap into the anger or energies of the community and get the public to demand X, Y, or Z direction, with zero money.
What I see, Celeste, is we're seeing speed, but I think that we all have to be applauding the fact right now that we are reconnecting average Americans with the political process and re-engaging their voices in the process. And, you know, beyond that first email that a citizen sends to their member of Congress or their state legislator, for that matter, or their local government official, I think we're going to see a more accountable government because, you know, once you send that first message, you want to know what happened on that vote. And I think we do remember in November now, and this process of reengaging folks with the process, I think, is going to reengage people to go to the voting booth, too.
That's interesting. So we could see an impact on voter registration and voter turnout.
I believe so.
Or voting online.
Hmm.
And that's a whole other subject.
Well, here's something. Can you hear this? This is paper. This is last night's newspaper. I tore this out the old-fashioned way. This is an item from last night's Champaign-Urbana News Gazette. It tells the story of the defeat of the campaign finance bill. Fails to make it out of the Senate. The Associated Press reports for Republican presidential candidate John McCain, the Senate's latest debate on campaign finance legislation may turn out to be something of a mixed blessing. McCain's signature issue, a bill to curtail the role of money in campaigns, is dead for the fourth straight year at the hands of a filibuster by fellow Senate Republicans. But the spokesman for the Arizona senator's presidential campaign claims the four-day debate coincided with a surge in interest, judged at least by his campaign website. Our hits went from a trickle, basically, up to about 22,000 in one day, said Howard Opinski, McCain's spokesman. Literally thousands and thousands of Americans who are now accessing our website, learning about the impact of soft money.
Mm-hmm.
The bill remains dead for this year, but there are benefits to McCain and the issue here. Are the benefits for McCain's presidential bid, excuse me, boy, I'm having a hard time today, for his presidential bid or the issue of campaign finance or both?
I think we don't know the answer to that, but certainly the fact that McCain has been able to connect clearly with voters online on an issue they care about is important and relevant for his campaign, if not for legislation. And what I think is very interesting, and we learned this in the 1998 elections. Voters are turning, like never before, to campaign websites as a source of unfiltered information about candidates. There's no spin there other than the candidate's spin. And people aren't spending time on the kind of the fun activities, the gimmicks that campaigns create, the campaign crossword puzzle or that sort of thing. What we learned from studies out of the last cycle was that people are spending a lot of time, an average of more than 7 minutes, according to one study that was done in 1998, looking at where candidates stand on the issues. Now, compare that to the typical television ad, and you recognize the importance of really putting where you stand on the issues on a campaign website, and that no longer is this a luxury item to have a campaign website. It is an imperative in the digital age. Even in the 98 cycle, America Online, it had an election section where people could find the candidates and go to their websites. They had more than 15 million page views to that site during the election season, and that was the off year. So the impact is enormous, and we'll see, I guess, whether whether this is a positive for McCain and a presidential bid or whether it's a gain for the issue. But I definitely think it is a gain for voters and for the power of the Internet as a tool for democracy.
Mm-hmm. It also brings up another interesting point. And if you take a snapshot of the political landscape online right now, you'll see that the Internet is being aggressively used by the underdogs. The Internet is being used by the campaigns that need to make their case to the American public and feel like they're at a disadvantage in the traditional mediums. They either don't have the name recognition of the incumbent or they don't have the buy-in of their party. They're using the Internet to try and form community and to energize voters and volunteers to build their campaign into a legitimate and a formidable foe for their opponent. In case in question, you look at the Bradley campaign versus the Gore campaign. Bradley started out clearly the underdog in the Democratic Party. He placed his internet strategist into his core team. When that inner circle in the Bradley campaign gets together, Lynn Reed, their internet strategist, is there in the room. When those five or six people get together to decide what course the campaign is going to take, what measures they're going to put to the forefront, their internet strategist is right there. Because of that, they've raised more than any other political campaign to date through the internet. They've raised over $500,000, toward their campaign. Whereas you look at the Gore campaign in contrast, Gore clearly the front runner. Well, that is changing. their internet strategy is three levels down. Hasn't even moved to Tennessee yet with the core campaign, and they're more concerned about making sure that they have a presence online, but that their involvement on the internet can in no way be used as a backfire mechanism to the campaign. They want to make sure that they have a presence on the internet, that they're putting their claims out there, but they're not using it in the kind of aggressive style that you see the underdogs. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing the underdogs being incredibly successful because of their aggressiveness online. And in the case of Bradley, he's almost getting to the point where he's quite the challenger.
Yeah. What makes a site good? And how do you measure success?
You know, I think there are a lot of answers to that question, Celeste. And you know, the first answer is you got to have one. If you're talking about a political site, I think it's the ability for people to go to educate themselves about an issue, to take an action, to volunteer for the cause. So to take an action, you know, maybe that means emailing Congress, or if you're part of a political campaign, maybe it's to tell a friend about the campaign and how to get back to the site. I'm a cyber activist by profession, and this is what I do. So when someone comes to a site that I work on, I want them to do something. Some sites, you know, the goal is strictly informational. In politics, you want to activate the grassroots base more often than not. And so we try to find strategies to help people organize themselves, to engage in a dialogue, whether that's, you know, around an issue, piece of legislation, or whether that's a candidate, and learn more about the candidate, and be able to do something with their time. And what I find most interesting now is that the tools are there for anybody out there, for any underdog, for any average citizen, to take on a campaign that they care about, an issue that they care about, build a website, create an email list, go to the venues online, move an issue, and they don't need to spend a penny. That's something that we talk about in the book, kind of the 10 steps, or net effect 10 steps for moving an issue online. And I think that's really exciting. And there are a whole lot of things that you can try to accomplish, but, you know, I guess the way Phil and I probably both look at the world is, from the standpoint of moving issues, you want people to come to educate themselves and to take an action on something they care about.
Mm. We're seeing a shift in the democratic process within our lifetime. I remember back as an activist for the Human Rights Campaign, one of the first issues that I had to face was gays in the military. And it was we had worked aggressively as a community to elect a presidential candidate, to elect a president who was going to support us on that issue. And in the first week of his administration, instead of being able to get settled into office and state to the world where he wanted to, where what his big initiatives were, he got sideswiped by the religious political extremist communities in America that were pressuring him to not to lift the ban in the military. And they launched a campaign, a phone campaign, mobilizing every single fundamentalist church in the country. And Pat Robertson on the Christian Broadcasting Network, every half hour, flashing the Capitol Hill and the White House switchboard numbers, getting their communities to pump in phone calls into Capitol Hill and the White House. And for a whole week, they effectively shut down basic business on Capitol Hill and in the White House. So many incoming lines coming in, demanding that they don't overturn the ban in the military, that the staffers couldn't conduct regular business. They were all answering the phones. And the Internet is just going to make that even more so, more of the democratic process and the need to mobilize in the grassroots even more important. Right now in Washington, you have your power paradigm of high-powered lobbyists and political action committees dangling money and schmoozing elected officials, you know, with high-powered lobbyists, and that's not going to win in the new world. Hmm. In the new world, you have to be able to engage the public on your issue or for your candidate, or you're not going to win. So we're going to see an incredible rise in the democratic process, and where that actually eventually brings us, you know, who's to say, but you're not going to win unless you can engage the public.
Yeah. It seems that we're seeing kind of a merging of traditional media and the net. Mm-hmm. In your book, Pam, you talk about a fellow by the name of Roger Hedgecock.
Right.
Who uses radio and the web. Tell us about him.
You know, and he's a great example. Roger Hedgecock, you know, the radio mayor, as we like to call him, he has used the Internet in such a way that he has created an online army for his positions on issues, and And he has created another way to communicate with his audience. So no longer is it just people turning their radio dial to his station. He's, in essence, broadcasting 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He's created a space where his supporters can communicate with each other, and they even take trips to Washington together to lobby on the issues. So it just sort of shows you the way that we've sort of blossomed into a mix of traditional media and new media. And we don't see radio or TV or phones or anything else going away. But what we do see is the net is sort of morphing these traditional technologies into just new and exciting ways for us all to communicate with each other.
How are the traditional media doing at adapting to this new environment?
I think we're seeing, Phil, I don't know if you'd agree. We're
I think very well.
We're seeing new and exciting things
MSNBC,
every day.
MSNBC. There's a lot of integration. MSNBC, ABC News Online. Every major newspaper in the country has a website where they're providing not just a mirror of their print publications, but also interactivity and online polls, et cetera, to engage the public in ways that the traditional mediums can't.
And I think it has, Celeste, you can probably confirm this for us, but I think it has put an additional burden, certainly some additional pressure, going back to this idea of speed on traditional media. When scrappy, net reporters can break major stories at late into the evening, it forces all of us, no matter what medium that you work in as your primary source, everybody's got to work 24/7 because of the speed of the net. You know, this idea of waiting for the morning paper to break the story, that's over.
Yeah.
I remember when Matthew Shepard when it was reported that the young man was in the hospital, he's the college student out in Wyoming who was brutally murdered because he was gay. I was still at the Human Rights Campaign at the time, and, you know, we found out Friday morning that this kid was in the hospital, and I tell you, I got maybe 2 or 3 hours of sleep a night for a whole week, just staying on top of it, mobilizing the community, putting out alerts. The web is a living, breathing thing. If you're in charge of a campaign, it's 24/7.
Mm. You know, Celeste, it also reminds me of the story. We tell the story in the book of Roll Call, which is, you know, a two times a week paper that is very much, we kind of call it Capitol Hill's kind of hometown news.
Mm-hmm.
When they broke the story that brought down U.S. Representative Bob Livingston and his bid for Speaker of the House, that story, you know, was broken because Roll Call had a website. And they beat the big guns. They beat NBC Nightly News. And when you watched the broadcast that night, you watched Tom Brokaw with, positioned behind his anchor desk was a computer monitor. And that monitor showed Roll Call online, which was the way in which that story broke.
Yeah. Well,
it gives rise to new media, new entrees into the news mediums, like the Drudge Report,
exactly.
Matt Drudge. Breaking the Lewinsky case, you know, in the first place, and pushing that this should be an issue in the public forum. So not only do we have our traditional players in the news industry taking advantage of this, but we're seeing new pioneers take advantage of it.
Yeah, it's harder to control a story now, and it's harder.
Yep,
it's harder to keep a secret.
That's absolutely true.
And in a lot of instances, when it comes to government, we don't want secrets. We want good, open government. But what about matters of national security?
That's a very, very, interesting question. I think that a lot of the focus of the work that Phil does and that I do is kind of opening our democracy to as many people as possible and freeing people to get access to information. But there is a flip side to that equation, and it's a very valid point. And as we look to Y2K, we look at opportunities for a lot of mischief on the net. and a lot of potential problems for, you know, for our national security. There are defense systems, if you will, that will break down on the net. There are opportunities for online espionage. It's all there.
And opportunities for cyber terrorism.
Absolutely.
Sure. We yesterday the organization that Pam and I both belong to, the CAPTN, the Communications and Policy Technology Network, we host monthly luncheons on different topics. And we just happened to have the luncheon for October yesterday, and it was on online guerrilla warfare, going into chat rooms and posting information anonymously or posting misinformation if you're doing, you know, covert nasty tactics. What are the ethics around that, and how, as ethical professionals in the industry, should we conduct ourselves online? And one of the topics that was brought up was hacktivism, and that's going in and hacking a website of your opponent, someone who opposes your view, and either putting nasty stuff about them on their own website or completely taking it down and replacing it with something else. I mean, hackers can go in and, you know, if they can get into the U.S., if they can get into the FBI and the Department of Defense site, surely they can get into Mindspring.com or Yahoo and change a website there. The question that question has come up with some of my more international friends in talking about real wars. When you look at what was going on in Bosnia, what would have been the ethics for the United States to go in and change the domain name addresses of the Bosnia, the official Bosnian sites, and make them inaccessible to the rest of the world? I mean, here we are killing people, you know, with our bombs, but is it unethical to go in and stop, you know, take down a website if you have the ability as a government?
Or what about hurting the military of an opponent, just going in and hack warfare?
Absolutely. But sure. I'm quite sure the potential is there. I happen to know that there are also, I would say, a lot of good guys out there. There are every day there are new friends, new companies springing up to help protect the interests and the security of companies and their websites. And it is an important business, you know, as we move forward and as we look towards Y2K and beyond. Protecting your information online, your face to the public, and oftentimes, you know, critical information about an organization or about a government, this is serious business. And I think you can kind of look at it all. We're learning as we grow online. The Internet is becoming such an important part of our daily lives and our businesses and our government. And it's kind of a wake-up call. You know, we're now at a point where we really have to take this stuff seriously. We really have to take the necessary steps to protect our data so that we can sort of move forward and enjoy the many, many, many benefits that the Internet has brought us.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and we're talking this afternoon about e-politics, cyber advocacy. Our guest's Pam Fielding. She's a policy writer and cyber lobbyist. She designed and launched the National Cyber Advocacy Program for the National Education Association. She is co-author with Daniel Bennett of the new book, The Net Effect, How Cyber Advocacy is Changing the Political Landscape. Can you access this book online?
You absolutely can. You can reach us a couple of ways. And as a matter of fact, Celeste, I will tell your listeners, and I really encourage them to do this, there is a free chapter posted on our site, Chapter 10, which I think is the most important. It's 10 steps that any person out there can take to launch their own advocacy campaign online for absolutely not a penny. So we give you our secrets from the work that we've done on how to do it yourself. So you can find that at www.e-advocates.com, and just click on the picture of the book, and you can access the free chapter there. You can order the book if you're interested.
Okay. Also with us this afternoon, Phil Addy. He's the former electronic media manager for the Human Rights Campaign. Today he is director of the Communications and Policy Technology Network. Phil, you want to give us a little bit of information about what that organization is all about?
We're a new professional association for the folks on the insides of your public affairs, policy, and political groups who are responsible for the Internet. We get together for monthly luncheons to talk about topics pertinent to our industry and how to use the Internet to engage the public on issues or for a candidate. And we have an online support center to help us in our professional careers and to pull together best practices and success stories that we can learn from.
Celeste, I will tell you that that organization has truly been a godsend for so many of us. When I was with the National Education Association, it was somewhat a lonely time because there were only a few of us out there that we were pioneering these new strategies, and there were not a lot of colleagues to turn to for support or guidance. And since that time, I've myself opened up an internet advocacy consulting business, do this full time, and still appreciate this growing ranks of political cyber pioneers who are doing this work. So we are kind of together, Phil at the helm, ushering in, we hope and believe, a new era of political democracy online.
Yeah. How many folks are out there doing this kind of work?
Oh, hundreds, as many as there are organizations. We right now only have a little over 100 folks here in Washington involved with the organization who are members, but that's growing every day. One of the most interesting observations I've had pulling this together is that you'd think that folks who work on opposite sides of the issue would have a little resistance coming together in talking about issues and strategy that affect them and their everyday jobs, but this is an interesting medium, and I've found that there's a maverick sense about everyone who's doing this, that excitement in Pam's voice about, you know, how incredible it was for her at the NEA to go where no one had gone before and pulling together a campaign overnight that had a significant impact, is inside of every one of us, regardless of what side of the issues you're working on. And when you bring those people together, they really like each other. They really respect the fact, even the, you know, you look at from the 96 election, Lynn Reed, who did the Clinton Gore campaign, and Robert Arena, who did the Dole campaign, you know, great camaraderie and great respect for each other because they are professionals and they had both done an amazing job with their campaigns. And it's been a real joy to pull together.
That's an interesting point because, Celeste, one of the things that we feel, I think, every day, every day when I go to work and get online, I feel like I'm on the front seat of the roller coaster with my hands up in the air. It is fun because you know that, you know, yes, we, the lions and the lambs, no matter what side of the issue we're on, we know that this is important, that 50% of Americans are now online, the U.S. adults are now online. And we need to reach out to them and reconnect them with the process. And I was working on a campaign with a group called the Patient Access Coalition, who was working to pass a real patient's bill of rights. And I had in my hands an email message from somebody who had visited the site and sent a message to Congress. It was a woman who had ovarian cancer, and she wrote that, "I have an 18-year-old and a 14-year-old. I want to see them both go to college." And her HMO had denied her last life-saving treatment for cancer, and she had to raise the money herself. And she told her member of Congress to do the right thing, and her member of Congress did the right thing. And no matter where you stand on the issue, you've got to feel that that's important because I don't think that's a voice we would have heard 4 years ago. But today we hear it right online, and we hear her loud and clear.
Yeah. Phil, would you spend a little time with us this afternoon talking about good and interesting political sites? I know that you have written Harriet Williamson, my associate producer, a little note via email saying that Jesse Jackson Jr. has a very interesting congressional website.
Representative Jackson's website is not so much interesting as a website in and of itself. Where he is interesting in the political landscape in Washington is he's the first member of Congress to have as their official site, as a member of Congress, also be their campaign site. most members of Congress have their official site. It's usually hosted on the House server or on the Senate server, and it's just their official site as an elected representative. Congressman Jackson Jr.'s site is hosted outside of Washington. It is www.jessejacksonjr.org, not .gov, which is a governmental site, and it's also his campaign site. And I think it's Renegade. It is.
That sounds like it just makes sense, though.
Oh yeah. Well, if you're looking as your political career to try and accomplish something, it certainly does. If you're using your political career, if you're using your position as an elected official simply to dialogue with your constituency, maybe not. But it does present some interesting dialogue in the political landscape. Who are these people that we bring to Washington? Once they get elected, are they simply to mirror what the public in their district wants them to do, or should they continue with their own personal agendas that they came into the battle with? And then that brings us to the whole philosophical discussion about representative democracy and the possibility of, once broadband communication is in every household, of possibly, you know, overriding that. You know, if you can poll the American public, the infrastructure will be built to poll the American public every night through secure vehicles on issues of the day. And do we want to turn more into a California referendum-type government where every night you come home and you vote on the issues of the day? And do we trust the American public in general to make those decisions? Or is it smarter to have elected officials in Washington who are briefed and educated on the issues to make those decisions, even though sometimes they may not be what we want? And, you know, Representative Jackson Jr.'s site kind of, to me, brings that to a forefront.
Now, I think, Phil, that I think we both agree that we trust the American public a great deal. And in fact, you know, thanks to the power of the Internet, American public is getting more and more informed and has access to just so much information at their fingertips to help their elected leaders make the important decisions that need to be made. And I just value the input of the American people back in the process using the power of the Internet. One of the interesting things that I've noted, Celeste, just looking back, you know, as you mentioned earlier, looking back at the release of the Starr Report online, and we actually experienced, you know, the House the servers on the Hill going down in response to the flood of incoming messages. We're seeing Congress taking a renewed commitment, if you will, to beefing up the systems there. And I don't know if you've heard, but there's a new site being launched, GOP.gov, the official site on the Internet for news and information from Republicans in the U.S. Congress. And I think that the Republicans, in essence, have thrown down the gauntlet. They're going to step forward with their own cutting-edge site. And now the Democrats are going to need to respond in kind, I think.
Oh, really?
Just to clarify my position, I didn't say that I didn't trust or that we didn't trust. I just said, just posed the question, do we? I mean, I'm more intrigued in the ethical and philosophical debate that will that is to come, not so much with the outcome. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, Celeste, this is a dialogue that I don't think is happening on a level that it should. When you talk about speed and you talk about the rapid growth of the Internet, we're not talking about a very long time frame that we're going to have before these issues come to head. I mean, just in a few years, we could come to the point where the possibility of getting 50% plus one and issuing in, referendums to have a constitutional amendment to create a new direction in government. You know, without the real painful dialogue taking place, and it's a dialogue that the politicians in Washington, many of the politicians in Washington, are afraid to engage in. Mm-hmm. It's a scary thing. It's a scary thing for all of us. We have one of the most stable forms of government in the history of the world. This is potentially the most volatile debate we'll ever have, mm-hmm. and it will happen in a very short period of time, and we're afraid to engage in it, and we shouldn't be. We need to. We need to start the dialogue. The intelligentsia needs to start a really strong, aggressive dialogue in where we should go with this.
Okay. Well, we've had a wonderful public radio discussion here this afternoon. I want to thank the two of you very much. Before we go, I might put it to you this way. Last issue, if we don't have this dialogue, could we see our feelings about the credibility of the web change?
Oh, that's a tough one, Celeste. I think that...
I have to make it quick.
Ooh, that is a tough one.
Yeah, well, I think the net is re-engaging people in this process like never before, and I think whatever happens, that is something that we're never going back on, and I will have been proud to be a part of it.
Hmm. I want to thank you, both of you, for joining us, and I hope we'll have the pleasure to talk again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Wonderful.
Phil Addy and Pam Fielding have been our guests in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. They are pioneers in the field of cyber advocacy.